You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of September 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, we look back over the week's biggest stories with a team of Monocle editors. We'll begin with the Apple tax row. Apple are furious, but the EU Competition Commissioner has hit back. We'll be hearing from her and discussing the rights and wrongs. Also ahead.
I'm going to continue to stand with the people that are being oppressed. When there's significant change, and I feel like that flag represents what it's supposed to represent, and this country is representing people the way that it's supposed to, I'll stand.
The American footballer Colin Kaepernick has been pilloried for snubbing his national anthem, but are those lining up to criticise him missing the point? Plus, I'll ask Monocle's frequent flyers, Andrew Tuck, Tom Edwards and Thomas Lewis, about the do's and don'ts of air travel. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So, welcome one and all to Midori House. It's the end of the week, and I must say, Midori House has the end of the week feel here. That
not with the quality of the guests, we might point out, but
no, not with the quality of the guests. It's just it feels like it's the end of a week. It's almost like the end of summer.
I think it's like the end of days, then, Steve. For a minute,
it's not that bad. Those two voices you've heard there, Andrew Tuck, our editor, and Tom Edwards, our executive producer. They're our guests for Midori House today. And Andrew, quite quiet week. Almost, wasn't it?
I'm not sure what you were doing, but it wasn't near my desk.
No. Compared to, you know, lots of people were out the office.
Lots of people were out the office.
Maison Objet, Josh Fennett was in Singapore. Lots of others were taking a little bit of a break before we engage on the November issue.
Kind of, but it has been busy in other ways. It's okay. Busy in behind the scenes stuff.
Yes, you've had behind the scenes busyness.
Yes, but not kind of on page busyness.
No,
I think that would be a fair assumption.
Okay, a fair assumption. And Tom, every day's a relaxed day for you on radio, isn't it?
I have a very relaxed demeanour, Steve, but like the traditional swan, there's busyness beneath
traditional
the surface.
Traditional swan?
Yeah, or the traditional image of
like
swan.
The swan.
Right.
Yeah.
Are you saying you're a modern swan?
I'll take it.
Okay.
Okay, well, there we are. Andrew, we're going to be talking a little bit later to Thomas Lewis in Toronto. And he's a very key part of what we're doing over the next few weeks, isn't he?
Yeah, so we shouldn't kind of jump too far. We have another issue that's just about to hit newsstands, which has our style survey, a retail survey, a good story about you, about who are the modern
a
Dutch.
A good story about me.
No, by you. And a very nice story that we pulled together about mayors around the world and did their kind of report cards for a new term. But yes, after that, which will be our November issue, we're doing a kind of a special look at Canada and all things Canadian. And obviously Thomas Lewis, being in our Toronto bureau, has been kind of heading all sorts of directions, as it were, to cover the nations. One minute he's got snowshoes on, next minute he's paddling across a lake. He's done the whole thing.
There we are. We'll hear from Thomas a little bit later, but I wanted to start today with the week's biggest story, really, which is the report by the European Competition Commissioner, Margrethe Vestager, who ruled that Apple had been given €13 billion of illegal tax benefits, her words, in Ireland. We are going to hear from Tim Cook in a moment, but first let's hear from Ms. Vestager, this interview that she did with Monocle 24 a little earlier.
It is strikingly simple to see that a company has been allowed to place a very, very, very substantial part of their profits in a company that is not being taxed, nor in Ireland, nor anywhere else. And that, I think, is obviously not fair, since other companies, they just have to pay their taxes.
Margrethe Vestager speaking there. Let's hear from Apple's chief executive, Tim Cook, who was rather indignant in this interview that he gave with RTE.
It's maddening. It's disappointing. When you're accused of doing something that is so foreign to your values, it brings out an outrage in you. Apple has always been about doing the right thing. We haven't done anything wrong, and the Irish government hasn't done anything wrong.
There we are. That was Tim Cook. Andrew, do you agree that Apple hasn't done anything wrong?
Well, I think there's going to be an appeal, obviously, to this judgment, and we'll find out more when that happens. And maybe on paper they didn't do anything wrong, because they may have been complying with, you know, a tax ruling that they found, and they put it to the Irish government. I think the key thing is, were they given an advantage that other companies weren't given? And I think that's still, you know, to be finally decided. But the reality is, we know that many big corporations, you know, whether it's Starbucks or Google, and we have focused on some of the big US ones, have managed to set up tax regimes for themselves that certainly seem to leave most of their income untouched. Perhaps because they leave it offshore. And the thing I find fascinating about this is, you know, until now we've had the US government saying something has to change. These corporations need to be bringing back their profits to the US, onshoring them so that they can be taxed properly and they can pay some money. The minute they get a judgment against them, everyone in Washington is saying, how dare you try and tax this poor, poor company?
Yeah, that's money that we have a right not to tax. How dare you tax it?
And the other glorious thing is, you know, an Irish government saying, please, please don't give us 11 billion, because that would, you know, be really terrible news.
It might be equivalent to our entire annual health spending, but we don't want it.
I think we all know where we stand on whether corporations should pay tax, but and I know we're going to dive into this topic at the moment. Yeah, I think tax is a fascinating thing. It's kind of galvanized all sorts of arguments in recent years. But, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, how much tax should people pay and do we want to pay? And then it becomes a bit more interesting, because, you know, people say, OK, we should pay more tax for that. I'd be more happy to pay more tax for the healthcare services in my nation, or for defence, whatever. And then you say to them, well, you point out, well, you can pay more tax if you want. You can just write a cheque and send it to the government. Oh, no, I don't want to do that. So people's relationship with tax is a bit funny. And then I'll just point out a very boring thing that doesn't really translate here. But the UK government does all sorts of things to let you dodge tax. So It says to ordinary people, we have a saving scheme here called ISA, which you put money in and you don't pay tax on it. And it's a tax dodge. And everyone's like, oh, I'll have a little bit of that. So we're kind of a little bit muddled about the world of taxes morality. So I don't like to pass too many judgments myself, because I think that we all kind of around the fringes of it. We're all given an option of paying more tax or less tax. Actually, most of us pay less tax.
But there's an issue here, Tom, isn't there? That it's one thing if, you know, this is the tax regime that a government has allowed and they've paid the tax and it's all fine. But it's when it looks like there's a little bit of finagling around the edges where companies have said, what happened in that country, actually the intellectual property of what happened is based in Luxembourg, say, or in Ireland or in Liechtenstein, where our tax rate is lower. Or you've had companies that have loaned their profits to another subsidiary in a company in a country where the tax rate is lower. It comes down to issues of ordinary fairness, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, but the issue, the reason that's complex is because it's what's fair and what's in the spirit of fairness. And this is what people always talk about with individuals who are seeking to avoid rather than evade taxes. It's what the spirit of fairness is. I think one of the key problems here, and I think the reason why people without Apple are worried about this, is that it appears to be a retroactive ruling. I don't think people mind that a tax regime can change, and that all of tax law has always worked that way. There's a change, it comes into a force at a certain date, and you move forwards. It's never retroactive. And that's enshrined in EU law, just as it is in most other global statutes around the world. And what it looks like here, I guess, to defenders of Apple on this, is that, okay, it's maybe politically motivated. Well, that wouldn't be that surprising. It's seeking to redress some unfairnesses that you've correctly identified, but it's being made to apply retrospectively. And that is worrying more broadly, because are we saying then for that the EU or the Commission or other countries or individual governments could retrospectively apply taxes on, what, profits made in their country? What's the cutoff limit? And I guess you're maybe opening up a bit of a,
on that point, then this isn't actually necessarily about retrospective tax. It's about saying that actually this is illegal state aid. So at the moment, governments aren't allowed to essentially prop up companies in their own countries, and that's the allegation that she's making. Andrew, is there a broader issue here, which is that as companies become more and more multinational, and there are more multinationals, it means that countries are going to have to work together or cooperate a little bit more if they want to make sure that companies don't go around, as they would see it, sort of shopping for the best tax deal? Or do countries just have to accept that, well, this is what happens when there's 200 nations and you set the rates that are right for your country?
Well, I'd say, you know, it has ever been thus. You know, that's why we know there have been such moves against, you know, the likes of Switzerland, Liechtenstein, all these areas and nations which were felt to be, you know, tax havens where you could avoid paying tax by registering companies. You know, and it's become a much, you know, tougher regime for most businesses, most companies. But there are still numerous places. Oddly, in the US, there are many states in the US where you can run your business from. You pay, you know, go to Vegas. You really do not pay many taxes if you base yourself in Vegas. But I think the public has to get in their mind what they want from these situations. I think, you know, yes, we want people to pay a fair amount of tax. Is it always going to be the same fixed rate depending on whether a company is based here or abroad? I think it's unlikely. And, you know, and I come back to this thing. It's, you know, how many times have you met somebody who says, oh, you know, the work on my house was getting super expensive, so we said to the builder, do you mind if we pay you some of it in cash? Now, they do that because they don't want to pay the tax. They find a tax dodge. Or they go to buy their house and they realise that if it was priced £1,000 cheaper here in the UK, they would be in a different tax bracket that they'd pay on the what we call here in the UK stamp duty. So they persuade the builder to cut by £1,000 so they pay a little bit less tax. We're all doing those tax dodges, well, not all, but many people are doing those tax dodges or taking advantage of moments in their life, day to day, where they can see an opportunity to pay a little bit less tax. We're not all Donald Trump, where we say, I've gone out of my way in my life to pay as little tax as I can. But even there, you suddenly realise on the right, there is an argument which says, no, central government should have none of my money. That money should stay in my pocket, and there is a moral argument to dodging tax because you should keep that money for yourself. It does not belong to government. So it's a little bit more ragged around the edges, I feel.
And just in the meantime, there's an opportunity here for post-Brexit London to step into the breach and offer the poor, put upon, lowly Apple maybe an alternative.
Yeah,
there
you're talking about finagling.
Their European operations. It'll be interesting to see how many people come running over. And will the attitude amongst the British public be the same once all this sort of direct foreign investment starts pouring back in?
And I guess the final thing on this is that we're also talking about things where it can be quite hard to work out where the profit has been generated. The argument over, for example, Starbucks was quite stark in the sense that you couldn't really claim that the coffee you bought, you know, on Baker Street was somehow the property of, you know, Starbucks in Luxembourg. But with Apple products that are sold here, are they necessarily...
I think that's a bit thin. And often it's about, you know, where advertising revenue arrives. Mm. I don't think there's that much. That's an unconvincing argument.
With the Irish, there's, you know, another good story from, you know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, when they went out to Hollywood and they said to people, come and make your films in Ireland and we won't tax you. We want to be seen on screen as an amazing place. We want to build up a film industry. Now, actually, no one really complained about that because they felt, oh, actually, it's exciting. We're on the big screen. They allowed companies, they invited companies to not pay tax. So you can't then say, well, we like it because we see some nice pictures of, you know, green fields up on the screen, and then say we don't like it when it's a tech product. Either you tax people at a set rate or you don't.
There's one extra just small thing to mention about Ireland, Tom, which is that because so many international companies that earn, you know, make billions have based themselves in some way in Ireland, it means that Irish GDP went up 26% in the last quarter. And it was, we were just, as Andrew mentioned, we just did this big story about the Netherlands. And we had a little fact in there about how the Dutch have the sixth highest per capita GDP in the OECD. As we were putting together the list, Ireland comes in at number four, ahead of America, because it's got all these companies that are based there.
Well, and I guess one of the problems that people have with this, again, is that illusory? You know, is it like having a high GDP per capita in a Gulf state? And what people worry about is the trickle down there? And I'm sure Apple and Tim Cook would say, well, look, you know, what's the broader economic contribution that Apple and all its employees make, and it weaves into the fabric of the economy of the country? I think people are reassured if people are at least seen to be paying their taxes fairly, that trickle down does actually happen.
Okay. Look at us putting the fun in taxation.
Okay, we're going to move on. And I ask you all to now respectfully either stand or, if you wish to, sit for this. The American football player Colin Kaepernick has again refused to stand for his national anthem ahead of a match. The San Francisco 49er is continuing to protest against the plight of black people in the US, and this time was joined by another member of his team. The pair were booed by some sections of the crowd. We're going to talk a bit more about anthems in a moment, but to stick with this right now, Tom, it's their rights to refuse to stand for this, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think people have also asked, is it an effective protest? Absolutely, definitely.
Talking about it.
Well, I think Colin Kaepernick has got a far higher profile than he had as a kind of slightly middle-of-the-road quarterback. It incites incredibly intense emotion in the US. We know they have all this legislation about what you can and can't do with the, you know, the stars and stripes, this kind of thing. I think it's excellent. Now, you may question his motives, and he's been subject to some incredible condemnation from sort of across the political spectrum, but I think more power to him. It doesn't trouble me in the slightest, and I think people need to be more relaxed about how we celebrate or choose to ignore various of our national symbols.
And Andrew, in a way, this is the perfect sort of protest. It's no one's got hurt, no one's been incited to violence. Someone's made his point about what he feels, and we can choose to ignore it or listen to it.
I kind of agree, and yeah, let Colin do what Colin wants to do. But I think there are two things here. One is, you know, that there is a different history that is played out in people's minds when they see this, which is of the Black Panthers. Now, the Black Panthers had many rightful things that they were protesting about, but it was felt in the background they were connected to things that happened in America that many people feel, even to this day, angry and unsure about. And it taps into that a little bit. So I think they have to be aware of that. And I think also at a time when race relations are very heightened, it will have, you know, it will have many other repercussions. And you shouldn't do these things feeling that you can make a protest which is ring-fenced. You have to accept that when you make these protests, there may be other repercussions. You know, you may not like them and may not want them and may not believe they should happen, but it taps into other feelings at a very tense time in the US.
But isn't that the point? So the point that Kaepernick's making is that the white establishment, as he sees it, is getting more upset about his decision to sit down before a game of American football than they are about, you know, essentially black lives being taken by the police on a weekly basis. So on that point, I think he is well aware that this fits into that.
I kind of agree with you, but I would be cautious of saying that all black people think that he shouldn't stand for the national anthem. I think many black Americans, including the president, would probably stand for the national anthem.
No, definitely. But this is what I'm saying. I don't think it's a black and white issue. It's about his freedom to make
assuming that everyone agrees with him. Now, let's move on to talk more broadly about anthems, because anthems, you know, they can make people angry, they can make people joyful, and we've chosen a few anthems that we think are particularly exciting. Andrew, since we have two guests that have snuck into the studio.
I'm going to go glass. You go first. No. Steve, you go first.
No, please,
because I'm going to win. You go first.
In the spirit of fair competition, we've been talking about.
Okay, fine. No, we're going to go with Tom's first, because I don't know who's put down what my pick is, because it certainly wasn't that one. We're going to go with Tom. Tom, tell us about your anthem. It's not the British anthem, obviously.
As I understood it, we weren't allowed to choose our own, and I wouldn't have done. My thing about anthems is they're, to my mind, they're always coloured by the context of where you hear them, or in some cases see them most. So I've chosen one that I'm used to seeing more often than not in a sporting context.
Okay.
And as such, sportsmen and women often deliver these things with a bit more gusto. So should we take a listen?
Should we have a listen to the Italian national anthem? There we are, the Italian national anthem, which was written, Tom, by...
It's not important getting bogged down in the detail, is it? It's what it does. Does it make the hairs on the back of your neck stand up, Steve?
Yeah, it's quite good. I feel I should have ice skates on or something.
It's got that uplifting. It makes you want to... I imagine looking out from some mountain eminence or something.
And Steve,
can I just point out... My show, I'm presenting this. Can I just point out...
You're not called Danny Joker.
When we discussed this earlier, I was adamant that we were going to choose the French national anthem. And yet, I looked to my script, it says, Steve's pick, Liechtenstein.
Let's hear it.
There we are. That sounds like... a slightly German version of the British national anthem.
But Steve, you're rumbled. It's because you're such a committed royalist, monarchist, that you wanted you wanted to hear the tune of God Save the Queen.
I'm known throughout Midori House as Monocle's most...
that's my favourite. Is that the only example of the same tune for two nations? I don't know.
I think it is. Or I think there might be one other. We had a really good guy on once on Monocle Weekly, whose name escapes me, who wrote a book about anthems. But anyway, okay, look, imagine that you'd heard the Marseillaise there, which is a stirring national anthem. I maintain the best, despite the fact I've got two Brazilian sort of...
Hold on.
Okay, Andrew, over to you.
Let me tee up mine. So I was saying to Tom that during the Olympics, that actually almost at the end of the Olympics, we had a discussion the other day, what you cry at. I cry at a lot of things. But anyway, I did cry at the end of the Olympics because Brazil... won the gold medal for football, and
Were you watching the football?
Yeah, or footballers. I'm not sure which I was watching. I was certainly watching something on the pitch. I think I occasionally saw a ball. I'm not sure what the ball was doing, but I was watching. I was watching with passion. But the interesting thing was at the end of it, when they won and they sang the national anthem, and they went along, the camera panned along the line of Brazilian footballers. You know, here are people from every kind of like background in Brazil, you know, racially mixed, an amazing group of young guys. And every single person was not just mouthing the national anthem, they were singing with gusto. And then the camera panned around the stadium, and there in the Maracanã, young women, kids, old people, all kind of caught up there, and I cried. I had a tear. But so what we're going to do here, we're going to have a snatch, as it were, of the official thing, and then just to prove my point that all Brazilians are amazing singers of the national anthem, we've dragged in Guy Lutz and also Fernando Augusto Pacheco, two Brazilians, one from Palestina, and one Carioca. So we're gonna jump over in it. But first, here's the real kind of like, well, the official one. Let's keep it going. Now our singers are gonna join in. Off you go. Oh, that's no passion.
I can't.
We should start again.
Yeah, okay, well, let's get rid of it. Let's get rid of the music, because I think it's confusing. I've got like £10 bet on you.
Okay.
If you let me down, you might as well get your coats on the way out. So off we go.
So we're going a cappella.
Yeah, okay.
A cappella.
Okay. One, two, three, go.
Ouviram do Ipiranga as margens plácidas de um povo heróico cado retumbante. E o sol da liberdade em raios fúlgidos brilhou no céu na pátria nesse instante. Se o penhor dessa igualdade conseguimos conquistar com braços fortes em teu seio, ó liberdade, desafia o nosso peito à própria morte. Ó pátria amada, idolatrada, salve, salve Brasil, um sonho intenso, um raio vívido de amor e de esperança, a terra desce. Sim, teu formoso céu risonho límpido, a imagem do cruzeiro resplandece. Gigante pela própria natureza, és bela, és forte, impávido, colosso. E teu futuro espelha essa grandeza, terra adorada. Entre outras mil, és tu, Brasil, a pátria amada.
How good is that? How good is that?
Not a touch on Liechtenstein.
It's an amazing song. And you know, before we move on, Guy, how come everybody knows the national anthem? You know, in the UK, we know like one or two choruses, and that's about it. How come you know every word?
I think it's because of football, but I think Brazilian schools are taught the national anthem. I wasn't taught in mine because I studied at a British school. But I think in football games, everyone sings, everyone stands, everyone's so proud.
Fernando, I've got a feeling that you watch the same thing on the football pitch as me.
Absolutely. But you know why I think Brazilians love our national anthem so much? As I was talking to Gaia, you know, it doesn't mention war or independence or anything. It's all about nature.
It's all about
connecting with nature, how Brazil's welcoming everyone. There's even a line saying, in our life, in your breast, there is more love.
And so look, this is my problem with God Save the Queen. Mm. It's not about the country. It's about one individual.
Oh, and you don't have a problem with the Marseillaise, which is all about spilling blood.
I know, it's about spilling blood for a reason.
It's about, well made, I think.
It's about preventing the people are coming and that they're coming over the hill and we're going to stop them and we're going to rise up and defend ourselves.
But a little bit like all those, the tune in the Brazilian one, it's kind of, it's that build up. It's so beautiful. Well, I've got my £10. You can leave your coats in the wardrobe.
Gala, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you very much indeed. We're going to head over now very quickly to Toronto. Thomas Lewis is on the line for us. And the reason we want to talk to Thomas, not just because he's such a wonderful guest to have, is because there is a new advertising campaign by American Airlines that's aiming to educate the less frequent flyer with some of the commonly agreed upon codes of behaviour. Thomas, you're flying around rather a lot at the moment. So we thought, why not ask you for your own thoughts on flying etiquette. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Steve. Gentlemen, how are you today?
We're all very good. We only have about 90 seconds left, so you're going to have to very quickly give us your top flying tips before Andrew Tuck mocks them and says what he thinks best.
I would say that I'm probably not the most popular passenger on a plane because sometimes I'm quite partial to taking my shoes off if it's a long flight.
But I have
very clean, sort of, you know, nice socks and clean feet and things. So I am aware of that. I've got my old shoes on. I'll keep them on.
Thomas, is it fair to say it's flying for you has not been the same since you could smoke 40 players while you were on your journey?
Yeah, I do wish I was sort of alive in 1971, really, where you could have sort of a smoking area and have all these sort of glamorous things around you. But I did speak to a very hardened smoker, even more hardened than me, actually, would you believe it, once, who said that smoking on a smoking flight was the most horrific experience of his entire life. So maybe we're not missing too much.
Okay, Andrew, would you like to sit next to Thomas Lewis with his shoes off?
Well, my fear is I've seen his expenses quite regularly, and I know that what he's eating in flight. He orders things like, you know, one onion ring, and that I don't want to be saying that under any circumstances. You've got like 20 seconds. How does the Welsh national anthem go?
Do you want me to sing it?
You've got 15 seconds. Why, 15 seconds.
Sing
okay.
us out. Sing
okay,
us
well,
out.
Listen, let me just summarise then.
No, it's about, no,
you've
it's got, about
you've got 15 seconds. Oh, sing it.
Here we go. My hin will advern.
I'm terribly sorry, Tom. We've got to cut you off there. We've run out of time. That was Thomas Lewis in our Toronto bureau. Many thanks to him, to Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Guy Lutz, and my two guests here in the studio, Tom Edwards and Andrew Tuck. Midori House was produced by Rhys James. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Checo. He gets everywhere, that man. And by Barclay Bram Shoemaker. The studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. There's music next. Then it's Marcus Hippie with The Menu, a Swiss special, I think, this week. The Daily is here at 2200. Midori House back same time on Monday, 1800 hours in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Have a wonderful weekend. Goodbye.